Prepare to be astonished.
It's that time again.
Let's get started.
From the Clatsop County Historical Society, an adventure in history with Matt Burns and Alana Quila.
You should never be allowed to talk to people.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
And now, with today's adventure, it's Mac and Alana.
Good evening, and welcome to an adventure in history. I'm Alana Quila with Providence Seaside Hospital, here this evening with Mac Burns, Executive Director of the Clatsop County Historical Society. How's it going?
December.
I know.
Holy moly.
How did that happen?
The year's almost over.
I don't even know what year it is, so let's just not even...
See, does it feel like it's still 2020?
Because
the last year, or is it just, thank goodness, 2021's almost over?
I did a report for work the other day, and I used all 2019 data, and somebody said, why did you do this? And I was like, really? I mean,
oh my goodness.
Really? Are you really confused?
See, we're comparing everything to 2020 and 19.
Okay.
Just because, I mean, I can't pretend 20 didn't happen.
Right.
But.
But when we talk about
we're up 200%
normal.
In attendance. Right. I mean, no, we're really not. I mean, we are, but that's not real. 2020 wasn't a real.
It didn't really happen.
It's a blip in terms of our income, our attendance, and our programs and everything else.
Yes. Memory loss.
Yes.
All those fun things.
It's December. It could be time to plug stuff, but
yeah.
Let's wait till next week.
We're getting there. It's still a festive season.
It is.
Yeah. We love it.
All right. So shall we get to the big history highlights?
Things
that happened tomorrow, December 6th.
You have some good ones.
1790. The U.S. Congress moves from New York City to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Good relocation.
See, I like having a city all, in theory, the capital city, that there's nothing else there.
Mm-hmm.
But if I had to choose between New York and Philadelphia, I kind of like New York City as our capital.
Of course. Yeah.
Well, Philadelphia is okay. I've been there.
Yeah. I haven't been to Philadelphia.
They got the Liberty Bell.
Yeah. Well, then they had this.
And they had for a while. They were the capital. All right. 1849. Harriet Tubman escapes from slavery in Maryland for the second and final time.
Good for her.
Good for her indeed.
Yeah.
You know, why isn't her image in more places?
Well, do you really want to know?
Well, I know that. That's okay. A rhetorical question because I do know.
I think we talked about this a couple weeks ago.
We do. But, you know.
Who writes the history books?
She's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So, 1877, Thomas Edison records himself reciting Mary Had a Little Lamb.
Oh. What an interesting choice.
Yeah.
Of all things.
I wonder what was on the list.
I know.
Or if that was the only one he knew.
Why that one?
1877, the Washington Post publishes its first edition.
Oh, that's good.
Was Tom Hanks the editor yet?
Yeah.
Wasn't there that movie where he was the editor?
Yeah. All right. Not quite.
1884, the Washington Monument is completed with the 9-inch aluminum pyramid atop the tower.
Wow.
It's a tiny little top to the tower. Now, I think we've asked this before. I've asked you this before. You've never been there, have you?
To the Washington Monument?
To the top.
Oh, no. No, I didn't even know you could go.
Oh, yeah. Well, okay. I think post 9/11 it was closed for a while.
Okay.
But, you know, there's a law that will be and always will be the tallest structure in Washington, D.C.
Oh, okay.
See, I like that. It's very pointy. I like it. 1923, the first U.S. presidential address broadcast on radio by President Calvin Coolidge.
That's good.
Silent Cal. So not that it's relevant here, but... for my birthday, my wife gave me a book about sex with presidents.
Oh, my gosh.
It's very, very graphic. So there's nothing that I can use for the show.
Okay.
But it is just, he's not in it. Calvin Coolidge is not in it. But it just made me think of some of the obscure ones that there's actually a lot of information.
Here I was thinking she put together your list of top presidents, but no, that wasn't it. Next time, Renee, next time.
Let's see. 1945, the Everglades National Park in Florida is dedicated.
That's a good one. I've been there several times.
So do you like it?
Yeah. It's not amazing. It's a swamp.
See, I'm not into swamps.
And it's huge. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And then you're like, why did I pay to come here? Because this is everything. But we do have a local, you know, Helen Smith from here, from Clatsop County. We interviewed her grandfather, Lauren Matthews, a couple months ago. She worked for the national park and loved it there. I mean, she went hiking, camping. She did like the canoe trips and stayed by herself on some of the isolated islands.
Wow.
I mean, so from her perspective, when I was looking at it, I was just like, wow, this is a glorious place that she was. It did not make me feel like the hot, sweaty, alligator-filled swamp that I was in.
Big
when
snakes.
I was told, you know, it's not the alligator that's going to kill you. It's the snake that bites you that will kill you first.
So. I was in a swampy state park in Arkansas once. And across the trail, it was down near like a muddy area. There was a snake. We only saw part of it, but its head was the size of a cement block.
Oh my gosh.
And I just thought, that's not right. Out in the nature. And we just turned around and it was, we were about a half a mile from being done. But we were both, the person I was hiking with, we were both afraid to keep going because this thing was in the trail.
So you double back.
So we had to go back like a mile and a half. So, I mean, it wasn't a bad 3 mile hike, but it was supposed to be a 2 mile hike.
Still.
But the thing was huge. I mean, I could see at least 8 to 10 feet of it.
Ugh, yeah.
Yeah. In nature. Yeah, 30 feet from
me.
Not
a fan.
Yeah, not a fan either. All right. 1964. I am a fan. Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer first airs on TV.
Aw.
But our history highlight of the day. Thing that I think had the most impact on history, 1865, the 13th Amendment to the Constitution is ratified, abolishing slavery.
Yep, you caught that one.
And we've never had race problems since. Equality for all, and then we're done.
Yeah.
But at least it was a step in the right direction.
It is. It's a step.
It was definitely a good first step.
On that note, too, 1955, a bus boycott began under the leadership of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. That was in Montgomery, Alabama.
Yeah, I like that guy.
Yeah, just a couple years later. So still working on things.
Okay, so the origin of what we're going to do today, I was going through, and I know you've heard me and our loyal listeners have heard me talk about, if you go on our website, historiamuseums.org, under research, there's a thing called the Internet Archive that we have been scanning. We've been doing a scanning project. We've been putting tons of stuff up there, including most of all of our old Cum Tux magazines, but just things that we have in our collection. And you can word search.
Oh, that's great.
It's not just the information we've put, the metadata we've put about each thing, but you can actually word search documents. And I was searching for something a couple of weeks ago. I can't remember if it was like Thanksgiving or whether it was for Veterans Day, but I found this really cool thing we've got. And I have to give a couple of shout outs, but basically it's newspaper articles about World War II local Clatsop County guys and girls that were serving in the military, and they would write letters home, and the newspapers locally would publish those a lot of times.
That's sweet.
So it's kind of an amazing
resource
of local stories, experiences. So it was actually put together by, it was something that was Bruce Burney had in the Astoria Public Library, and then a volunteer, Medora Svensson, organized them and kind of pasted them into... a photo album kind of thing,
which
we
don't
scrapbook. We don't really like the when you glue stuff in, but so be it. And then Lisa Penner kind of went through it and put these together. So they're not the complete stories necessarily, but we think they're kind of cool.
Yeah, some letters.
So we thought we'd share.
And so we have men and women.
Men and women. So the first guy that I thought I'd share about is Sergeant Ed Reed, formerly the manager of the Cornet store at Seaside. And we're actually going to edit these because sometimes the language is perhaps a little inappropriate.
Well, sure, they're in war zone.
Because they're in war zone, and the enemy is the enemy.
Right.
So we may let it slip if we read too fast, or we may edit on the fly here.
Got it.
But Sergeant Ed Reed, formerly the manager of the Cornet store in Seaside, wrote of his introduction to war as a member of General Bradley's army that landed on the French coast. We did not arrive on D-Day, but shortly after, which was plenty close enough. We work with the combat divisions and have mobile units which repair on the spot everything that quartermasters issue, including shoes, clothing, metalwork, equipment, and machinery of laundries, sterilizations, and bath outfits, bakeries and coffee roasters, fumigation plants, refrigeration vans, typewriters, heaters, lanterns, stoves, and field ranges.
Wow.
That is like a jack of all trades there.
Yeah.
I have discovered that war is not a pleasant thing and has no glamour whatever. On the contrary, war is a lot of soldiers doing a lot of jobs under most trying conditions and personal hardship of dust and mud, dullness, danger, disease, and tragedy. I wish you could see St. Lô in France or the ruins of it. St. Lô was a town slightly larger than Astoria, snuggled in between ridges of hills that almost surrounded it. The buildings were constructed of stone and clay, usually 2 stories in height. The walls were from 8 to 16 inches thick and built close together in the typical European style. After the fighting had passed over the town, not one building was unscathed. A few had been gutted out by shells and bombs, with 1 or 2 walls standing. The balance was just rubble. Closer to the front, the smell of war is in the air from the stench of the dead. Animals and humans alike. The blackened and bloated faces of Americans and Germans, the equipment scattered over the area, makes the war seem like a fantastic nightmare. It is with a strange mixed feeling of emotion that one sees Yank and German helmets lying side by side, finally reconciled, the burned out tanks with only the stench to account for their crews. A little further back from the front, the French are trekking back to their homes with their belongings in baby carriages, wheelbarrows, or on bicycles. They all wave happily despite their personal losses, pleased that the war has passed over them and left them a free people again.
It's an amazing document right there.
Isn't it?
When Anita Winblad of Elsie enlisted in the Waves, she was the fourth member of her family to go into the armed services or merchant marine. Her brother Henry was a sergeant in the army serving in North Africa when he was captured and taken to Germany. Her brother Oliver was a lieutenant in the army. Another brother was a steward with the merchant marine in the Pacific. Inez Nelson of Cannon Beach, who served at Camp Farragut in the Waves, wrote to her parents about taking part in a Navy Day parade in Spokane in November 1944. It was thrilling, and when the band played Anchors Away, I had to choke back the tears. I'm not the least bit sorry I enlisted. I'm very happy here. The service is the only place for me while there is a war. Virginia Fulton, a Wave, was in boot camp at Hunter College, expecting to go to Yemen school. Our first week wasn't exactly heaven, she said. You know how one feels, not liking to be herded around and drilled constantly, but it's all in getting used to, I think. Maybe. Mm-hmm. Lieutenant Phyllis Moore, a nurse with the 76th General Hospital in Liege, Belgium, helped treat wounded soldiers during the 5.5 months that the area was in which the hospital was located was under V-bomb attack. A V-bomb landed on a section of the hospital during one attack, but the hospital continued to receive wounded soldiers for treatment. Lieutenant Moore graduated from Seaside High School and attended St. Mary's Hospital Nursing School in Astoria. On September 21st, 1944, her letter was printed in the papers. Just wanted to say hello. I'm using my helmet as a table out in the middle of a field. I haven't written for quite some time as I've been on the move. Got a day off and went to London. Saw Big Ben, House of Parliament, Westminster Abbey, Hyde Park, Buckingham Palace, Wax Museum, etc. Then across the channel to sunny France. Slept in a hammock while crossing the channel. Came up on the beach and landing barges. We are still living in tents, eating K and B rations. Not bad at all. You should see me in fatigues, leggings, helmet, and my hair in pigtails. Such glamour. We are living an outdoor life. It is really rugged.
Okay, she almost makes it seem like a pleasant little safari vacation. And I can't picture using your helmet as a desk.
I know. Going across the river in a hammock.
In a hammock, yeah. Yes. Corporal Arnie Raudio of Astoria wrote to his wife in 1943 about the battles in the Sicilian campaign. We were fighting continuously for 14 days, and I really had some close calls. There were so many times that it could have been me instead of someone else that it wasn't even funny. Boy, at times I prayed like I've never prayed before. We were just about landing on the beach when they opened up on us with artillery. I was really scared because they were landing all around the boat. Boy, what a relief it was when we hit the beach. Later on that morning, we had to take another hill, which was quite well fortified. As we started to advance up the hill, a sniper starting to pepper away at me. The only thing we could do was to keep moving. A person should never stop unless he absolutely has to. One of his shots landed about 2 feet from my foot, and the rest whizzed around my head. I got through okay. The following day, we were under machine gun fire and a little artillery fire. It was then that I finally realized that when a person's time comes, he just can't do anything about it. I had 6 shells land about 15 or 20 feet away from me, and the last one took the top off the tree I was hugging. I am fighting in the best outfit in the Army, barring none, and I really am proud to be a member of such a great outfit. We have surpassed all feats accomplished by any outfit in the history of the American forces.
Wow, there we go.
Well, that's pretty bold. During the time we were in combat, I'll bet that we walked over 200 miles if we walked an inch. I think we walked about 50 miles in one day. I wouldn't swear to it, but really felt as if we did, the way my feet felt that day. We were on the go continuously. We passed through quite a few towns on the way. When we entered one town, the people went crazy with joy. They started to mill around in the streets, and for a while we thought we were going to have a riot before we could quiet them down. Across the street was a building the enemy had been using as headquarters. The people broke into it and started to throw everything out into the street. There was a fascist emblem on the balcony, and they started to knock it down. It was quite a sight to watch. You will never realize how happy a person can be to know that he is an American and what a grand life we have compared to the people in other countries. I never did realize it until after I came over here and saw how the people have to live.
Mamie Chan, daughter of Mr. and Mrs. Singh G. Chan and graduate of Astoria High School, wrote her relatives in August of 1943 that she had resigned her position as a bookkeeper in the government office in Washington, D.C. and joined the U.S. Marines as a clerk. Lieutenant Hilda Pitkinen Eliasson, an army nurse in Hawaii, wrote the Astorian Budget asking them to print a correction. She was, she says, the first Astoria girl to serve overseas in the war. An article just after the war noted that she was the chief nurse in charge of two army hospitals in Shanghai, China. Emma Babcock, a corporal in the WACs, took advantage of her spare time while serving in Italy in 1944 and 45 to visit Pompeii and the Isle of Capri. The former Seaside High School teacher planned to include all her observations in a book to be titled One Gal's War.
One Gal's War. Lieutenant Alan V. Sellers was sent directly into action when he arrived in Europe in January 1945. He wrote his parents that he was with the 9th Infantry of Hodges' 1st Army in Belgium, and that he and his men were at the front in trenches 3 feet wide, warmed only by a small stove against near zero temperatures. On February 3rd, he received shrapnel wounds in his left arm, for which he was hospitalized. About the time that his parents received their son's Purple Heart award for this injury, they were notified that he was wounded again, this time in the right shoulder and ankle, and again hospitalized.
Oh my goodness. Margaret Peggy Wood of Astoria was among the group of specially selected invasion-trained Red Cross workers to land with American forces on the beaches of Normandy on D-Day. She had previously been assigned to duty in England. She landed by army transport in Cherbourg, and immediately took up work of establishing recreation facilities for the men of the armed forces. After serving more than a year with the American Red Cross, Club Mobile Services in England and France, Joe Schwab was hospitalized with combat area fatigue, according to a newspaper article. At one point earlier in her career, she had written that her quarters were in a 15-room house called the Rectory that she shared with a British colonel and his wife. Among the enjoyable touches, they had a maid to turn down their beds at night, a butler named Ireland to wait on them at the table, and, quote, even a bicycle to ride. Joe Schwab had written, sometimes our job seemed very small, making and serving coffee and donuts to men in isolated areas and meeting troop ships from the states or battle areas. A reporter for the Astorian Budget wrote that what seems like such a small thing can mean is seen by the following letter from Astorian Martin Gullahan in the Italian Hills, which is also reprinted here. Yesterday, we had a first glimpse of some of the work the Red Cross is doing over here. A couple girls, not bad looking either, of course.
Of course, we got to comment on that.
Came up to our outfit and served coffee and donuts. They also had a photograph and state books for us to sign. As luck would have it, just as we received our coffee and donuts, a fire mission came down and most of us ran to our guns. As luck would have it, it only our gun fired. When we were finished, we all trotted back to the kitchen and the girls, mistaking us for first, handed us another ration. We were the only ones to get seconds, and of course, we never enlightened them. Those donuts really hit the spot, as did the appearance of two genuine American girls on the scene. Gulligan had received 5 battle stars after his battalion had been dug in at 58 different positions in 30 months.
Coffee and donuts and girls.
Yeah.
Lieutenant Delmar Putnam of Seaside was a veteran of the forgotten Italian campaign and had taken part in some of the bitterest fighting there. He wrote, having seen many home newspapers, I know that the Italian front hasn't been given much space for the past few months. Actually, something is going on continuously, not large-scale battles, but countless little scrapes between patrols, platoons, and companies. Many frontline platoons battle the Germans hand-to-hand, night after night, for weeks at a time. Putnam's regiment, the 362nd, part of the 91st Powder River Division with the 5th Army, had broken across the Sieve River and gotten to the top of Mount Calvi, where the Germans had placed artillery in tunnels running 50 feet underground at the rock. The outfit had captured 400 Germans and killed and wounded many others in 11 days before the drive. I'm kind of amazed that they keep getting newspapers, like, back and forth.
Wow. In January 1944, Elmer Manula received a letter from Arthur Thomas, a former Astoria police officer who was stationed in the Atlantic. Thomas told him that he was wearing a sweater knitted in Astoria, and he wrote, "You can imagine my surprise the other day when I was issued a sweater to find in the garment bag of the tag of the Astoria Red Cross chapter. It was just like a letter from home." That's nice. I like that one.
Seasider Meredith Groves wrote about the Atlantic crossing he made to get to Europe, where he was a combat infantryman with the 86th Black Hawk Division. I can no longer say that I have not been seasick, for during a particularly rough spell, I lost my equilibrium and was in very low spirits indeed for about 8 hours. During that time, I turned up my nose at a turkey dinner and would not have minded much of the ship had been torpedoed. I soon recovered my appetite, however, and I am feeling all right again. About his later experiences, he wrote, "We were not in action very long, but it was long enough to lose 11 men killed out of a company of 186 men together with more than that many wounded. We were in action for nearly 50 days, starting on the west bank of the Rhine. We crossed the Rhine on a pontoon bridge, which was not too bad. When we came to the Elbe and the Danube, the going was tougher. We crossed in boats. They then fought through the Ruhr Valley and into southern Germany against fairly strong opposition. Once the war ended, we had time to look about, and we were surprised to find that we were in a marvelously beautiful country, the German Alps."
Wow, yeah. Once they can actually pay attention. Private Charles Stellwright of Astoria wrote his father from Australia late in 1943, "Had a strange thing happen on the boat. Every once in a while, they give us free packs of cigarettes, and of course, the name of the donor appears on each pack. The one I received had compliments from the Astorian budget. Don't you think it's quite a coincidence? I couldn't believe it for a minute. In case you think of it, thank them for the bunch."
thanks for giving me cancer.
Yeah.
So here's a name, Lieutenant Kermit Gimry.
Oh, nice.
Served with the Bloody Bucket, 28th Division, which saw action at St. Lô in France and battled through Normandy, paraded through Paris, went through Belgium and Luxembourg, and smashed into the Siegfried Line on September 11th, the first troops to enter Germany in strength, according to an article in the Astoria Budget. On August 14th, 1945, Lieutenant Gimry saw action in 5 major European campaigns: Normandy, Northern France, Central Europe, Rhineland, and the Ardennes.
Ino Koski, who was with the Company L for a time, was serving in Australia when he wrote Deputy Sheriff Myron Jones that, "I'll take good old Oregon anytime. This country just hasn't got what it takes. No timber, no mountains, no fishing streams. Why not even a good cow pasture?" He said that it was still hot in the jungles and swamps in New Guinea and that the men sank into the mud up to their armpits. He sent the following poem to his parents, and it was printed in the budget in May 1943, titled Astoria. "O little town of Astoria, our home beside the sea, we sit every night in joyful delight, hoping to return to thee. O little town of Astoria, our home so far away, we sit every night by the candlelight, hoping for us you pray. O little town of Astoria, we think of you every day. We hope to return safely, although some will have to stay. O little town of Astoria, to God we kneel and pray, hoping he will guide us to you, Astoria, someday."
Wow. But can you dance to it?
It's a nice one, probably, but we're not going to sing it.
No, we're not. No. Seasider Arthur Ulmer took part in what was billed in January 1945 as one of the most unusual incidents of the war in Germany. While serving with the infantry, Lieutenant Ulmer found himself cut off and entirely surrounded with a small group of doughboys who had lost their captain. Some of them had been disarmed by the Germans during a false truce asked by the Germans to remove the wounded. Ulmer ordered the Americans into a strongly built stone house, which he felt would give them the best protection, and then by radio ordered the barrage. For 7 hours, he kept on calling for more and more fire on the village. Finally, the Germans, who were in a more exposed position, had been so badly cut up that the small group of Americans were able to clear the village.
John Hickey of Seaside, a seaman cook third class in the U.S. Naval Reserve who was serving in the Alaska area, wrote his family in July of 1943, "I am very homesick at the present time and would give anything to be home now with my feet under the table and mother's wonderful cooking on top." He said that he was writing this letter by the light of the lamp we have rigged up. It is a gallon of bacon grease in a can with an empty machine gun belt used as a wick. He spoke with pride about the fluffy pancakes he could make and said, "Fluffy isn't the word for them. When I have my home and kids, I can show you how I used to cook hotcakes in the Navy, just like you, Dad. Remember how you used to cook us kids hotcakes on Sunday morning and also had that great session you had trying to show us how high you could flip them? Those were good old days. What I wouldn't give to have them now and know what I know."
Wow, that's one of my favorite ones.
Yeah.
So Bob McCullough encountered a lot of mud in Belgium. His letter was printed in a December 28th, 1944 newspaper. "This mud seems to have all the qualities of ordinary mud, except that it is very much dirtier." I don't know why that makes me laugh. You get it out. You get it on you, and then after it dries and falls off, it leaves a black stain. As for the blanket situation, I'm always congratulating myself. I have managed to sneak into the European Theater of Operations, ETO, a commercial-type sleeping bag lined with wool, a comforter which was left behind when one of our boys fell in a hole and broke his arm, three GI government-issue blankets, and a GI sleeping bag. Sometimes it is necessary to sleep out in the rain, and on those occasions, I always try to get on high ground. I remember the time the water rose to about 6 inches and ran into my bag, keeping the water at body temperature. One time during the night, I had to get up and work for an hour or two, and on returning, found the water had voluntarily lowered its temperature to suit itself. That's one of the times I stayed up all night. Ooh. We had a delicious Thanksgiving dinner on the 23rd. I don't know whether that was Roosevelt's holiday or the Pilgrims, but it was swell. The mess officer and I, who are constantly on the alert for things to do, spent the entire night going around to the ration breakdown point, the water point, and various cafes. The cafes contributed the wine. We did the rest. After taking care of our driver and the detail assigned us for the job, we proceeded to the quartermaster in charge of the turkeys a little bit drunk. We got a regular issue of beautiful young toms and, in addition, about enough additional young toms to feed another company. Also cranberry sauce and other fixings. At the company kitchen that morning, we presented the cooks with the food, with the loot, and calmly went to bed. Don't get me wrong, I'm not ordinarily connected with the kitchen, but on special feature festive occasions, I can be had for the price of a few shots of champagne. Hmm. Did you ever try drinking it out of a bottle like beer? You may get the idea that war is all fun from the above accounts of my adventures. Well, it is not. Not by any long shot, but I managed to get a kick out of it no matter what goes on.
That's a good one. Kind of a nice little memory. Albert Richards, a member of the infantry outfit in France, wrote in late 1945, "I have just finished reading my first edition of The Signal, which arrived this morning, and I can't tell you how good it makes me feel to see that name again, especially in the hospital. I've been in the hospital since January 6th when a German bullet hit me, and I can add my little quotation to what many other people have said. The Germans are tough and tenacious, as we have found out."
Wow. Don Moss, former resident of Seaside, wrote from France in November 1944, "We moved the other day, finally left the woods, thank God, and we really have a setup here. We're working in a schoolhouse and living in an old factory about 5 blocks away. Of course, this isn't the Astor Hotel, but it's a roof over our heads and we have lots of straw to sleep on. This is a fair-sized town, and one of the main features of it is the number of cafes and their untold quantities of the closest thing to American beer that we've seen yet, cold and even ahead on it. So you know where I spend the most of my time. I should be quite content with this setup. I'm clean, have clean clothes, and just got back from having the works at a barber shop. I'll be darned if I'll shave myself while I'm here, as long as we can get a barber shop shave for 5 francs. About 10 cents in good old American cash."
It's kind of interesting, the two different types of letters home, right? The ones that really have a different sort of vision that they're portraying to mom or dad or whomever. Well, that, and then the others that are really, I mean, they are sad and it's hard and they're homesick and it's not fun.
Well, you wonder like that one that, mm-hmm. Hey, I'm shaved, I'm living on straw. Yeah. If that's just to make mom and dad feel good,
sure.
And don't worry about me, or whether that really is like, hey, I had a couple of days of fighting and now I'm just kind of hanging around.
Well, waiting. And even the Thanksgiving one where he said that, you know, if you think this is how it life really is, it's not.
Yes.
But that was it. So,
yeah.
You know, no more story. So good stories. Thanks, Mac.
Yeah, we didn't even hit the Japanese in the Pacific theater. So we might have to revisit this someday.
Yeah, we have more to go.
But and maybe we'll tie it in next time instead of just things that Mac was looking for and found something else that was kind of cool. So,
well, we did hit the Thanksgiving one.
That's true.
Yes.
Although, you know,
a little late.
Past Thanksgiving.
I know, but that's okay.
Okay. Well, go make some history. We'll catch you next week. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for joining us for An Adventure in History. An Adventure in History is created and produced by the Clatsop County Historical Society and brought to you by KMUN.